Welcome back to Farm Foundations, the podcast where we dig deep into the world of homesteading and sustainable living. I'm one of your hosts, Tyler Lowry, joined by my co-hosts, Bo Prock and Joe Grissom.
Hey there, folks.
Howdy, everyone.
In today's episode, we're going to wrap up our poultry series, and we're going to have a focus today on poultry care and management. But before we dive deep into that, let's take a look back at the highlights and updates from the past week with our weekly week in review segment. Joe, what have you had going on this week?
Well, we had a tornado, so that certainly killed in one afternoon that we typically don't have to spare. But fortunately, we didn't lose anything other than a crabapple tree. And a lot of gravel that got washed down the driveway. So I got up this morning to what looked like the Grand Canyon, and I had to stop what my plans were and go into driveway repair mode. But other than that, we flamed the show cattle. I worked in the greenhouse some more. I worked with Tyler building his soldier fly farm. We butchered a steer, which led to a beautiful oxtail soup last night. We processed some soap, and I bartered some tomatoes with a neighbor.
That sounds like a busy week, especially even with the storms. We think when we get bad weather, you know, a lot of times we're not able to get as much done as we want, but sounds like you were able to keep pretty busy even with all the rain we've had in the last week. Bo, what have you been up to this last week?
So I was part of the crew chasing that tornado last night, so my last night pretty well was shut down. We were supposed to actually be here, you know, doing stuff last night, and that delayed that a ton. So all of my plants besides my tomato plants are all on the ground growing in the raised beds. We built and added dirt to four more raised beds this week, and I have my little helper kid building another very large raised bed tonight while I'm over here. I had Jessie, the quail lady, the poultry lady, come over to look at the quail like we had talked about on the last episode, and found out that my fears were correct. Out of the almost 20 birds that I had, I think 15 of them were males, so we were not going to get any egg production. So I had to butcher, I think I butchered 12 birds or so yesterday. Or day before yesterday. And then I did some bartering with Jessie. So I think she knew that I was in quail trouble whenever she came over to sex the birds for me. So she had brought a one male and four females with her. And I got to see size difference. Her quail are fantastic. They're nice, large, healthy birds. I got those quail from her, and I traded some a couple butchered rabbits and a stick of summer sausage that me and Joe made a couple months ago. Then she decided she wanted some rabbits, and so I was able to barter a trio of rabbits for some more quail and three blackberry, thornless blackberry bushes. And I think tomorrow I'm going to butcher a couple more rabbits. So it's been extremely busy this week with everything going on.
It's been busy with all of us. Joe mentioned earlier, we got some soap made this week, built a soldier fly farm. I still haven't got my garden in. We've been talking about that for a couple of weeks, but we've just had so much rain every day that it's really made it kind of difficult to get out there and get that tilled up initially and get things going. Hopefully it'll calm down a little bit this week, but I think that's kind of the extent of my week. As far as things go. So before we jump in here, I just want to do a quick series recap. Our first episode in this series, episode 3 of our podcast, we did a poultry primer. We just kind of took a look over homestead poultry husbandry. Our second episode that dropped last week was poultry infrastructure. I think we've got some social media posts up and some pictures for you guys to go and look at as far as what we've got kind of on our own homesteads. And then this week, we're going to finish up this series, and we're going to talk about bird care and management. We're just going to take an in-depth look at that today. So as we get started and dive right in here, our first segment, that I want to talk about today is just an introduction to poultry care. So I want to talk a little bit about the importance of proper care and management, and then just a short overview of basic needs for our birds, housing, feeding, and watering. I know we may have covered quite a bit of this in some of the previous episodes, so you might go back and listen to those if you haven't. But Bo, if you want to kick us off and just kind of go over some of these things.
So, I mean, I think importance of proper care and management is the same thing we're going to talk about with any other creature that we have on any of our farms. You know, it's paramount. If you are looking for good egg production, a good quality egg, good quality meat, and just the overall happiness of the animal and the enjoyment that you can get out of that, I think all those are huge. You get into, you know, more segmented areas of proper care and management. If we're going to talk housing, you know, I think they need some place of shelter. You know, no matter what that is, there's lots of different styles out there that I think, you know, we can delve deeper into, but they need some kind of shelter. As far as feeding goes, I'm getting way more and more into just kind of mixing my own feeds, and I think that's as much for me as it probably is the birds, just because I'm enjoying just kind of seeing what kind of general feed I can make by mixing, you know, four or five different things that I'm buying at the store and keeping them in water. I think chickens handle the heat. So far in my experience, they have handled the heat way better than the cold. As long as they have access to some good cold, fresh water, they seem to thrive. And, you know, that's when I think egg production is the best.
I'm glad you mentioned mixing your own feed. I feel like, and maybe Joe, you can answer this question. I know you mix quite a bit of your own feed as well. Does your feed mix change over time as your flock changes, as you grow up different birds and that flock just changes over time? Does that change how you feed, and does that change your feed mix on your homestead?
Tyler, that's an excellent question, and the answer is real simple. Yes, we can manipulate our birds' productivity by changing their feed somewhat, but we still have an awful lot of seasonality that takes place due to the daylight hours. So chickens lay the most in the spring when they get the right amount of sunlight. It has to do with the rays that comes through their iris, and it triggers hormones in their brain. The brain says, make more eggs because you're going to have babies in the spring, and raise them while you have some opportunity. That's a holdover from when they were wild species, and you can lengthen that. We can play with the lights in the coop. We can play with the nutritional. We can lengthen that from what we call winter layers or summer layers. We can manipulate that egg production as we see fit. But the fact of the matter is, birds need a higher calorie, specifically a higher protein diet, late winter, going into spring, and throughout the spring. When the summer heat gets here, the heat gets really oppressive and their eggs numbers will drop. So I will lower my protein levels during the summer when they're not eating as much. There's no sense trying to force them. And then in the winter, I like to go to a higher fat diet. I feel like it helps, the fat calorie helps keep them warmer. It's what we would call an endurance calorie, and it's the type of calorie that's needed for them to survive when it's too cold to get down and eat, or if their pan is frozen or what have you. They need the extra reserves of fat on their body.
I think calorie cost is an important conversation to have when we talk about managing animals. I listened to a podcast a while back, and it was more of an kind of an outdoors podcast. They were talking about elk populations, but the calorie cost of producing antlers every year has a huge impact on the life cycle of elk. And I think that applies really to all living animals. We have different needs as humans. When it's summertime, you're eating a lot of salads and lighter things. You're not going to go have a big meatloaf and gravy and biscuits and all that stuff necessarily when it's 120 degrees out for lunch and you've got work to do. So as we manage our animals, I think we need to kind of keep an eye on what our animals need, what kind of calories they're expending, and how we can supplement and make our animals' lives a little bit better doing that.
Tyler, that's a great illustration.
Do we have anything else just kind of on our introduction here? Any big things that we need to know about proper care and management before we dive a little bit deeper and talk about some health and disease management?
I just want to reiterate what Bo said about water. You know, we have in any sort of biological life form, we have five essential nutrients. Those nutrients are protein, fat, carbohydrates, vitamin, minerals, and most importantly, and typically overlooked, is water. So out of those five nutrients, the single most important nutrient that a bioorganism needs is water. So again, if it's dirty, if it's too warm, if it's unavailable, it really has massive implications on the health and well-being of any biological life form.
I know I was talking, Joe, with your wife, Liz, yesterday. Just me personally, as a human, I take some medication that really it is reflected in my hydration. If I get too dehydrated, if I sit in the hot tub too long and get super dehydrated, I mean, it's a noticeable, it's almost crippling how quickly dehydration affects me. And I don't think we pay enough attention to that, especially if you're healthy. You may think, oh, I drink enough water. But if you've got a sick bird, if you've got a bird that needs a little extra support, that hydration is super, super important to all aspects of their life, not only their quality of life, but their production and their livelihood on your homestead. So as we dive a little bit deeper, let's talk about some health and management considerations. So what are the big common health issues that we find with poultry species? Bo, do you want to kick us off here?
So I'm going to be real honest with everybody. This is not going to be the segment that Bo's going to talk a lot on. As far as health issues that I have seen in my birds, so we just had one. Actually, one of my quail, we had a prolapse quail that Jesse found for me that had just happened that I had to butcher. And then I've had one or maybe two chickens that were egg bound, which, you know, I didn't know anything about until that happened. Other than that, I think, you know, I've heard a little bit about like mites and stuff that can, you know, really affect your poultry. But again, this is definitely going to be Joe's area to shine here.
Joe, what have you got for us as far as health issues that we need to be aware of with poultry?
Well, I wish I'd have seen this a little ahead of time. I maybe could have written down some notes that are a little better than what I've just put down flying off the cuff here. But we'll start with egg bound, and I think Bo touched on that, and that's one that I feel like a lot of homesteaders will that every homesteader will eventually incur. And this was just simply where, for whatever reason, the egg doesn't pass like it should, and it's not unlike being constipated. The bird will become very lethargic, and its head will droop, and it'll show signs of discomfort. And really, there's not a lot you can do other than to put them in a warm water bath. And I would like to remind you that the skin of poultry, all poultry, even ducks, is not waterproof. So if you leave them in a bath too long, they will absorb water through their skin and eventually drown, if you will, from having too much water. So we want to set them in there for short periods, you know, maybe 5 to 7 minutes max. Then we want to go in there. If that doesn't do much to help the bird relax and help pass the egg, then we need to go in with some sort of a lubricant. And a lubricant that you might have at home is typically sufficient. If you don't have any sort of body lubricants, for lack of a better term, then we make use of vegetable oil or even margarine, butter, anything that we can get in that bird's vent. And this is absolutely an opportunity where we glove up, and as carefully as we can, we go in there and try to manually help that bird pass the egg. So egg bound is something that should be looked at very carefully. A lot of folks feel like that they have a lifelong commitment to this chicken, and I respect that. But you certainly don't want to breed any, or you don't want to hatch any eggs that come from a chicken that is suffers from being egg bound. So typically, I laugh and say a little margarine on the vent goes a long way, but a little margarine on the breast goes even further. So at this homestead, the chickens either work really hard for me or they work really hard for Colonel Sanders. They've got a choice. Guys, I'll treat a bird for being egg-bound once. The second time, I help her find new employment, if that makes sense. Secondly, one of the things that comes from hygiene and is coccidiosis. Chickens will very rapidly develop a diarrhea or a tarry-looking stool that comes from coccidia, and it's fairly simply treated. There's things you can buy at the farm store that you add to their water, but if you don't act very quickly, the bird will die from dehydration. And I like to remind folks, diarrhea doesn't kill animals or people. Dehydration does. So when you see an animal, whether it's your chicken or your cattle, that have very thin and watery stools, you need to act yesterday. There's not enough time for you to think about it and talk to your friends. If you see thin or watery stools, act now. So, and with a bird that weighs just a few pounds, particularly a young chicken, if they develop coccidia, you know, they can dehydrate in a matter of hours. So let's make sure we're keeping our water pans very, very clean. I don't necessarily think you have to add bleach every day, but you certainly don't want your birds drinking out of a pan that's full of feces. Prolapse, of course, is one that Bo discussed already. And there are some people that can successfully treat prolapse. But again, I think a prolapse bird really should be humanely dispatched. It's hardly worth the effort to do it. And certainly if that bird's going to do it again, the eggs, passing an egg is difficult, and they do it every day. And if for whatever reason that egg is too big or their body, their anatomy is too little, you're just going to prolong their suffering. So, again, prolapse is something that I act very quickly on. And that being said, a prolapse is really not a bad issue because the bird itself is completely salvageable. I've got no problem eating a prolapse bird. External parasites is one that you'll have to see. We should remember that poultry, all species of poultry, have to have a regular, if not daily, dust bath to help control the mites and lice type bugs that live on their feathers. They spend, if they're not eating or sleeping, birds are grooming. So we need to give them a pan where they can lay down and roll around in the dust. A cat litter pan works great. Some people put diatomaceous earth in there. I say be very careful that you get food-grade diatomaceous earth, not an industrial or pool-grade diatomaceous earth, because those will cause upper respiratory issues, particularly in goats. So a lot of the homesteaders want to be very homeopathic and stay away from some sort of toxins, and I respect that and agree with that, but diatomaceous earth is not the cure-all. A good, light, powdery, clay type material in a cat litter pan is pretty effective without adding diatomaceous earth. My grandfather, if you're less concerned about toxins, my grandfather mixed up his dust baths with a couple of cups full of powdered seven dust. And those birds would go over there, and he kept that, of course, under a shelter. And the birds would go over there, and it seemed like you'd never see them, and then all of a sudden you'd see every bird there. And guys, seven dust is made from a product called carbaryl, and it's a fairly benign toxin. I'm not so sure that that's not the right way to go if you are suffering from external parasites. And then lastly is internal parasites. And guys, we can talk about coccidiosis and things like that. And by the way, the treatment for coccidia, or the preventative now for coccidiosis in commercial farms, is cinnamon and oregano and or. Turkeys seem to do better with cinnamon. Chickens better with oregano as sort of a prophylactic preventative of coccidiosis or diarrhea in general for commercial farms. So that's obviously something you can do, adding oregano to your blend of chicken mix. You can buy that, just the stuff you buy to put on your own food. Buy it at Sam's. It's fairly inexpensive that way. And dump a pound container into a 50-pound bag of chicken scratch will go a long way in preventing diarrhea. The same is true. There's some anecdotal evidence that shows that same oregano is helpful in prevention of internal parasites. So chickens are real bad about getting roundworms. So we want to make sure that, again, we're using a litter process that keeps our chickens away, or a litter that will desiccate chicken manure very quickly. So regular use of sawdust or shavings or chipped newspaper, whatever you have, some sort of absorbent material under the roost is really important to help it prevent internal parasites. Remember, 80% of that chicken's waste comes out at night. So under the roost is where we want to make sure we have that absorbent material. You can use any variety of absorbent material, coconut coir, sphagnum peat moss. I happen to be using a blend now of newspaper and wood shavings. But that way, when the poop lands on that material, it sucks the moisture away and it prevents the transmission of internal parasites. Now, again, if you're going to fall back to my grandfather's way, there's a chemical called piperazine. It's a liquid. It runs a 4-ounce bottle. It should cost you under $10, $12 maybe at the most for a 4-ounce bottle of what they call chicken dewormer. And piperazine is really, really effective in stopping internal parasites. So if your birds look lazy, if they look dry feathered, if they look just kind of frazzled and worn out looking, the first treatment that I tell folks is piperazine, to be followed up with a little dab of wheat germ oil applied over the grain. Wheat germ oil is the highest source of natural vitamin E, and although it's expensive, the birds respond to it very, very quickly in the luster and in the shine of their plume. So I know I said a lot there, but you asked, Tyler.
No. That's exactly what we're looking for. I do want to talk a little bit more on this segment, specifically to the preventative measure and kind of biosecurity aspect of health and management. And I feel like, you know, I've got a little bit of experience in some commercial poultry operations. And I feel like we see health issues a lot more frequently. I alluded a little bit earlier to a podcast I listened to about elk. And one of the things that they found was that these elk feeding lots, if you will, which essentially is a spot that they put out and they just throw feed out. And it was initially supposed to help the elk population. What they found very quickly was you bring thousands of elk and you put them in one spot to eat, and they have health issues run rampant. So I know both of you kind of said that maybe you have a little bit less concern over health issues. Anecdotal as it may be, would you contribute that to having a much smaller flock and a flock that you're interacting with a lot more often? Is that something that you think improves the health of your birds?
I think you're exactly right, Tyler. In most states where they outlaw baiting of wildlife, that's the reason. You know, if we're going to put apples out to bait deer or bear, it's because when those animals frequent the same area over and over and over again, that's where the things like coccidia or other diseases, Newcastle's, for example, take place. So you're right. For me personally, on my egg-laying birds, where they're in a permanent housing facility, I'm really diligent about having clean and regular changing of litters. And when I say regular, it's annually, but I add to it every other day, probably. So there's not an opportunity for the birds to come in contact with old feces. Now, my fryers, when we raise fryers, they're moved every day. So when we talk about a chicken tractor, the importance there is that waste is left behind and the birds are forced onto clean and undamaged ground. So I think that for the homesteader, because it's a smaller flock and we're paying more attention to the, I don't want to say more attention, that's probably not fair to commercial producers, but because we're interacting every day, to use your terms, I think that those health issues, the birds typically are healthier and they will live longer than they will in a commercial setting.
Bo, would you attribute some of your luck to that?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to be said, and Joe, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but whenever you start putting multiple species of animals, you know, like chickens, goats, sheep, cattle, rabbits, quail, whenever you don't have a lot of crossover in the diseases that are most prominent to those, right?
Correct.
And they almost kind of help. So in our instance, whenever I was free ranging our poultry, when the cattle and the sheep put fecal matter on the ground, the chickens would go through that and scratch it and eat the bugs out of it. That otherwise, had the cattle or sheep went back over that same ground and, you know, picked around on the grass really close to that, they would have picked up, you know, those worms or those, you know, bugs and stuff that could have made them sick. So I've always heard, again, I'm not going to lay facts out here, but like whenever we had the avian flu, the bird flu in our area, they always said, if you had one, you know, specific species of bird in your backyard, you were way more likely to have avian bird flu in your area. Whenever there was multiple species, you know, cardinals and blue jays and robins and all that in the same area, it was a lot less likely. And I think that is something, you know, I just really like animals. So, yeah, I want a little bit of everything. You know, I want to see what we like. But I think that has something to do with it. You know, if I don't really have any biosecurity protocols that I would say on my farm right now, but when we were really doing a lot of breeding dogs and selling dogs and stuff, towards the end of that, we got very, very particular about letting people go anywhere near our kennel. Like if they were there to look at dogs, we would have a handful of them to pick out in our backyard, far, far away from the kennel. And, you know, really, we almost got to the point to where we wouldn't let people, you know, just handle all of them, at least without us watching them cleanse their hands or something first. But, you know, I think if your farm's managed well, you have a bigger concern with somebody else bringing something into your farm than it being there off the get-go. So that's all I'll say to it.
I know we talked a little bit earlier in this series about a quarantine process when you bring new animals onto the farm. Joe, do you want to speak a little bit to a quarantine process and why? I know biosecurity is a big word and we don't really think about that, but a simple, you know, quarantine cage where you put that new chicken in and let him hang out for a week to make sure you don't have issues. I think that's important. Do you have, what's your kind of quarantine protocol when you bring something new into the farm?
Well, certainly that is, and Tyler, and that's a great subject, and I could probably talk for hours on it. But in general, I say, first of all, every person needs to have a set of what I call town shoes. You do not leave your farm, go to town, go to the feed store, walk around, go to the veterinarian, walk around, and then come back to your farm. You leave out the front door and you go to work on your farm out the back door. And you have two very different set of shoes that you take off and change. So I'm a Croc guy. I like to wear Crocs. I got different colored Crocs for different intentions. So if you see me with camouflage Crocs on, you know I've been to town. If I've got blue Crocs on, I'm not leaving.
This is going to be my favorite subject we've talked about so far. I love it because I'm a Croc guy too. Go with it.
It's just as simple as that, guys. Really and truly, when you go out and about to the vet, to the dog park, to the feed store, you are bringing those diseases from every other farmer in the area back to your house. And most of it is going to be oral fecal transmission. I think we spoke about that on other podcasts. And there's no better way than to have a farmer stomp his muddy boots off in the feed store floor. And you step on it and it travels back just to, remember, it only takes one little bacteria to make it back to your farm and you've got a disease outbreak. So most of the time it travels on your shoes. Bo touched on washing hands. I think that's really, really important that we take a minute and to do that. Understand that on a commercial application, when feed is delivered in an 18-wheeler, that they stop and they spray off the truck when they enter the farm and when they leave the farm. So twice that truck is getting a disinfectant on the tires so that it doesn't transmit. I don't think that when we talk about biosecurity that we can be more careful. Now, to Bo's point as well, the more varied the species, the less likely we are to have it. But that doesn't mean that you throw caution to the wind. So for my house, it's really diligent hand washing with soaps. We like to use a good strong lye soap, and we have specific shoes for specific jobs. So we're just awfully careful about that, and remember that while most diseases don't transmit from animal to animal, when we talk about the farm, things like brucellosis will. And if we start into the dairy world, and we'll have a topic on that soon, that's a great way to get your family sick is to have dirty hands and go milking a cow, or to have dirty eggs that sit in the floor too long. And that's the reason that we do this, you know, while we have poultry, is so that we can put a better egg on the table that's less likely to make our family sick. So don't ruin the whole process by not washing your hands before and after you go gather eggs. It's as simple as that.
I think something really cool you said there that might be like one of those little token nuggets that people take away there is you've got to remember where we put our feet is where animals put their noses and their mouths.
Well said.
And I think that, like, I heard that in what you were saying there, and I think that's really something important that everybody ought to take away is, and that's not something that I would think about. I'm thinking about washing my hands, but, you know, the bottoms of my feet is where my animals are putting their mouths at.
Yep. Far more likely. And by the way, every time I walk in, my dogs and every other species of animal on my farm wants to smell where I've been. So if you're gonna bring home disease, it's likely on your shoes.
I think I don't think we could spend enough time talking about preventative measures.
No, I don't either.
Especially when, you know, some of our principles, I'll just throw out our three principles because we're going to talk about them almost every episode, hands down. How it's bred, how it's fed, and how it's dead.
Amen.
So when we want to control those three principles, and we want to do that in a way that's maybe not overusing prophylactic antibiotics, when we're not over-medicating our animals, we're trying to keep that to a minimum. And I don't want to talk necessarily harshly about that because if you've got a sick bird,
treat it.
I mean, it's better to treat it than to let that animal die. And we talked about that in previous podcasts as well. So I'm not saying necessarily just outlaw, blacklist that stuff altogether, but you can go a long way. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that old adage has become cliche, but it holds true and it will hold true. The way that we prevent these issues will make or break us on the homestead. Unless we've got anything else that you guys really want to hit on health and disease management, we'll slide in to our next segment, and we'll talk about egg handling and incubation. I know both of you guys have done a little bit with incubation. Joe, if you want to kick us off, and let's talk about, let's just start with proper egg collection and storage.
So guys, I'm very, very, very focused on clean eggs. I keep a paper clip in my chicken coop that holds sandpaper. If I see a speck of manure when I gather an egg, and by the way, I gather eggs daily. If you're diligent about your egg gathering and you learn your birds' individual cycles, you'll know what time they lay. My birds lay at about 11:15 every day. If I go down at 11, maybe I have one egg, but I don't have all my eggs until about 11:20, 11:30. So about 11:15, I know that my birds, I need to have it on my hand. So I go down immediately thereafter so that the birds don't have time to get in there and step on with their dirty feet on my good, clean eggs. So secondly, I make sure that I've got clean straw or clean bedding material for them. Or here recently, this last 2 years, I've switched over to a rollout nest box, which I really, really like. Now, roll-out nest boxes, although the eggs come out much cleaner, still need to be regularly sanitized. They come with a plastic AstroTurf, if you will. And that needs to be taken out and dusted probably weekly. Monthly, it needs to be washed and sanitized. Annually, I think it just needs to be changed altogether. So a couple things on the egg collection. If I see a speck on it, I sand the egg with that sandpaper. I don't even take them to the house. We do not practice washing our eggs because when you wash an egg, it needs to be immediately refrigerated. You've washed off what we call a bloom, or what I sort of say, and it's extremely unpopular in my household when I call it, but when that egg comes out of the hen's vent, I laugh and call it cooter juice. And that cooter juice has got beneficial bacteria that's called the bloom. And those eggs are protected against bad bugs, if you will. But it can only do so much. And if you wash that off, then those eggs need to be refrigerated, and they will not grade as high as an egg that has not been washed and refrigerated. For the record, in the United States, it's illegal to sell eggs through traditional parties that haven't been washed and refrigerated. If we go to France or to Europe in other countries, eggs are never refrigerated. They're simply sold in smaller volumes. You go, instead of a dozen eggs, you buy two eggs or six eggs. And you buy them more frequently so they don't have an opportunity to age and bring disease into your house. Remember, an eggshell is porous. And without that cooter juice protecting it, it will absorb any sort of disease that happens to be in its area. So cleanliness in a chicken coop is paramount.
Bo, do you have anything more specifically on storage of eggs? What are you doing to store your eggs? Are you a refrigerate guy or a table egg guy?
We've got the rollout nest boxes. And pretty well what we will do is and they do a really, really good job of keeping clean eggs. Like, people need to understand that a speck of fecal matter or something, one out of 18 eggs, you know, maybe, you know, a close ratio. But usually what we will do is that egg that does have, you know, a speck or something on it, you know, we'll flick that off, you know, whenever we pick it up, we'll take that egg in and we will either eat that one the next day or we'll wash it and just throw it in the fridge and then we'll eat it in the next couple of days. We're pretty well on the same plan as Joe. I mean, they sit in a big wicker basket on our cabinets, our countertop, and we keep those rotated. We've got, you know, a couple different baskets, so we start in one and then move to the next so we can make sure that we're not letting eggs go too far. I really like the egg rollouts, though. I don't know if you guys have seen those little deals you can buy where you drop them in this little deal and it spirals down to the bottom. So you always are eating your oldest egg.
Huh.
Those are cool.
Yeah. First in, first out.
Yeah. First in, first out.
So to talk a little bit more about egg collection and storage, I know there's... I feel like mainly this topic has been eggs for consumption so far. There's several different ways that you can preserve eggs. There's water glassing. The other day I read a little bit, I think it's an Irish method, but they would butter their eggs to preserve them over the winter. Have you guys heard about buttering eggs?
I have not, Tyler.
So I just kind of looked it up here. I've got a little click. Essentially, during the winter when these Irish farmers were not having as productive hens, they would take freshly laid, still warm eggs, and they would rub them and roll them in butter. And the butter would help solidify the shells. It would seal off the pores in the shell, seal them off from the outside air and from contaminants. And they were able to store their eggs just by coating them in butter. And I think that's kind of a cool deal. Joe, I know you've done some water glassing as a different preservation method. Can you give us the lowdown and dirty on that?
Sure. So basically, water glassing for me is just a very strong lime solution. So to water glass, the recipe is a half cup per gallon of water. And you'd make up your solution of water and put eggs in a clean jar, clean eggs in a clean jar, and then cover them with the solution of lime and water. And it says it's okay for a few months, you know, that you, if you do them in the fall, that it'll last through the winter. I've probably got eggs upstairs that are a year old, year and a half old maybe, and they're great to bake with. But I will tell you, to fry one, it's they're pretty flat and they don't really stand up like we would, you know, to have a sunny side up or an over easy egg. I think they lack a little in egg quality. But if you wanted to use egg as a protein, to, as a binder for baking breads or baking a cake, they're fantastic. Now I do want to have a little segue here that says this is pick or water glassing eggs is not approved by the USDA. So we need to be very cautious there and make sure that we don't get some sort of litigious freak that wants to yell at us because they got sick eating a rotten egg.
That's, you know, I feel like we discuss a lot of things. Obviously, please do your own research on these things and decide if that's right for you or your family. We don't want to tell you to do something that's going to make you sick. Please look into it yourself. Always verify whether it's from us or a different source. I feel like it's always a good idea to kind of double verify what you're hearing and make those decisions as you see fit.
Now, that being said, I do want to remind everyone that not every person that works at the USDA is experienced in homesteading or even animal agriculture. So just because it's not approved doesn't mean that it won't work.
So as we kind of segue into the end of this segment here, let's talk about the basics of incubation and hatching. So when we gather these eggs, is there a different process? How long are we storing these eggs before they go in the incubator? What's that timeline look like, and what are some considerations we need to have there?
So for me, when I get ready to incubate eggs, I want to tell you that if it's too dirty to eat, you can't incubate it. If it's a dirty egg, the chances of you successfully hatching a chick out of it are slim to none. So it's really important that hygiene for a hatchery egg facility is 10 times greater than the eggs produced for your table. So just take that with a grain. You know, think about the billions of birds we eat every year. Those birds are coming from the very cleanest farms there are. Those eggs are coming from the very cleanest farms. So it's, for me, clean hands, maybe even a gloved hand, pick that up, put it into a clean carton, not a used carton, a clean new carton. Begin tilting it every 12 hours minimum from the time that it's laid to the time that it goes in the incubator. It needs to be tilted and moved every day. But I don't keep them any longer than 30 days. So about 30 eggs to, if you have one egg a day, you need to keep your eggs for 30 days and then get them in the incubator. And then, of course, we need to adjust the humidity to make sure that we get upwards of 55% or greater for the humidity in the incubator. But if you think that I was crazy about my cleanliness on table eggs, incubation eggs are even cleaner.
But what about you? What's your experience been in incubation?
So I'm fairly new. We just ran our second batch of hatching quail eggs. The first batch we bought off of Amazon, and it was, I don't know, like 30 or something quail eggs. And we had close to a 50% hatch rate on that, which talking to several people said, you know, from mailed in eggs, that's not a bad hatch rate. The second time we tried, we bought a bunch of eggs from the local auction, and they were just junk. I think we ended up getting 3 birds hatched. Two of them were very sickly when they hatched. So we're going to kind of back up just a little bit on that. I'm only buying quail and probably only hatching eggs from Jesse, you know, for a little bit until we get our entire deal kind of set up. Now, the birds that I've recently got for her and barter, we will probably start collecting those eggs and try to hatch those ourselves. But if I wanted to do a big batch right now, I would probably just buy from her to see what my hatch rate should be. I've heard, you know, extraordinary numbers of, you know, 80%+ whenever you're doing it yourself and doing it right. So that's more where I would like to be at.
I know when I worked in commercial operations, I worked in one conventional farm, and that was hatch eggs. The other farm was table eggs. But on the hatch eggs, I worked there gathering eggs, and I feel like handling your eggs is important when you get ready to incubate, because as you gather those eggs, you feel it's hard to even put it into words, but when you pick up an egg, you can kind of feel the discrepancy, or you can say, hey, this egg just...
It's too light. It's too heavy.
Too light. It's too heavy. The shell feels weird. It feels thin. It feels thick. It feels...
Coarse
or whatever. So by handling your eggs yourself, and maybe that's not, you know, that's a great chore for your kids to go do, but it's important for you to also handle those eggs, especially when they go in the incubator. The farm that I worked on, we had a really, really, really good hatch rate. And that's because the guy that owned it came out there. And for the first probably 2 to 3 weeks I worked there, he stood right there at the table beside me and said, hey, feel this egg. This doesn't feel right. It's not going to hatch. Call that egg. So I feel like that's an important skill. Just kind of knowing your eggs, knowing what they feel like, knowing what normal is, and culling or, you know, eating those outliers will really go a long way. Anything else we need to discuss on incubation before we move into brooding chicks?
Not that I can think of.
All right. Well, we'll get right on. So when we brood chicks, let's just start kind of at the very beginning. How do we set up a brooder area? And what does that look like? Bo, do you want to jump in and tell us what your brooder looks like?
So I'm getting ready to build a really cool one. I found some designs online that I really like. Currently, we have a repurposed rabbit tractor that I decided I did not want to raise rabbits in tractors right now. I think that's something we will get to maybe later this summer. But so we have that. It works really good. We have it in what was our whelping room for our puppies. Temperature controlled, so I can really manage that temperature, whether, you know, it be summer or winter. But, you know, I see lots of people with one of those clear totes that you buy from the dollar store, you know, brooding chicks and that in their house. And I think that's fine. I think it's important to keep it clean. You know, we use some different shavings. I'm pretty fortunate, the place I work, we end up shredding a lot of papers. So I've been able to take, you know, the shredded pieces home and keep that kind of scattered out. But, you know, the dog pee pads, you know, I think I saw that this week on a, I think it was an Instagram post that somebody made. And you know, that makes a lot of sense. That's super, super absorbent. And it's easy to clean, you know. The shredded newspaper, or just paper in general, is kind of a pain in the ass to clean. It sticks, you know, real bad to the toe. It doesn't catch at all. You end up having to, you know, really kind of clean it up anyways. So I think, you know, going back again, if I was going to raise one in a tote in the house, like we've done in the past, you know, some pee pads would go a long way on that. And again, just like we say with everything else, clean food and water in there for them.
I know when we think about these brooder areas, what do we need to keep in mind as far as temperature and humidity? Joe, do you have kind of ballpark numbers for us on temperature and humidity in a brooder?
Well, it depends on the age, and we can go back and get some very concrete numbers, but the number of days old versus the temperature decrease, but when a bird hatches, it should be the same exact temperature that what he was incubated. So depending on your species, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 degrees. But what I like to share with that is whatever that brooder looks like, it should have redundancy. So more than one heat lamp. When the weather or the temperature changes and the temperature drops, the birds are going to want to gang up underneath the heat source. And if there's not enough room, the weaker birds, the smaller birds, the less aggressive birds will get pushed away, and those will be the ones that simply get sick and die. If you don't have a secondary source, or in the case of a commercial setting where they've got, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of baby chicks hatched on the same floor, there's a lot of different heat sources so that those birds can travel around and find a place where it's a little less crowded. So redundancy is important. In my operation, Bo talked about his, in mine, I like to use a wood pellet, like you might find at the farm store for heating your home with a pellet stove, a wood pellet that I put down as a base, and then I spray it with water, and then it will absorb and break up, and it makes a very dense sawdust layer. It'll swell up and become very fluffy, and it allows good purchase and or footing for those birds, and it's something that they don't want to eat. So I think that's particularly important that you find a good substrate for the birds to absorb their feces and not encourage them to peck at it. Then I put down cardboard or newspaper or something that I put their food on. The first few days, I like to scatter the chick starter crumbles out and around so that they have opportunity to just kind of peck and learn. And then by the time they're a week old, they can eat out of a tray fairly regular. But the temperature is critical. That the first couple of days, it's the same temperature as where they were incubated. And then as they age, drop it down. Humidity is less important after they've hatched than it is with chickens, because they're born at a very different rate of finish than others. So for example, a puppy should be brooded at 55 to 65% humidity, 65% being ideal. Well, that's nearly impossible in some of our Western states. So if you live in, say, Utah or Nevada, you know, you may have to add water to your poultry house to make those birds where they'll grow. Conversely, in the Southeast, where it's very, very humid, you know, upper respiratory issues and fungal issues are something to be concerned of. So we want to make sure that our humidity isn't much higher than that. So if you're sitting still in the shade and sweat still pouring off of you, your birds are probably suffering. So we need to incorporate some sort of artificial air movement to decrease the humidity level.
As we move on a little bit, we think about feeding and watering our young chicks. I know, Joe, you talked a little bit about feeding. Bo, what are you doing for watering? I've seen a lot of videos of people putting water dishes out with marbles and different things in them. What have you got going?
That is exactly what I was going to talk on. So one of the biggest lessons I learned with the first round of quail that we hatched out was, you know, we had a 15% initial hatch rate. The next day, we woke up and four of them had drowned in the water bowl. So, you know, quick online kind of look around on that. And my daughter used to make jewelry, you know, all the time. So she had all kinds of little beads and stuff laying around. So we found some pure plastic beads and put those in the water dish to keep that from happening. We had really good luck since. But I haven't raised chickens yet from the egg. But quail will sure enough drown themselves overnight and I'm talking a quarter inch deep, you know, deal of water, if that. I'm not even sure it was that deep. I mean, there was very little water in there.
And they drank it all when they drowned.
when I touched on it earlier, but I want to reiterate the fact that poultry, ducks included, their skin lacks the water barrier that our skin has. So for example, we can go sit in the hot tub for hours or go swimming all day long, and our skin is still waterproof. Or we hear the old adage about a frog and his parts being waterproof. That skin will retard water. Poultry will not, even ducks. And ducks require, they've got a gland on their tail head that's called an oiler. And those ducks, you'll see them, they'll work back by their butt, they'll run their beak through their tail feathers, and then they coat their feathers with a grease or an oil that helps keep them buoyant and waterproof. But chickens don't have that oiler. So when Bo says they drowned in his water, likely those birds just stood in it for too long. They don't even have to get it in their lungs. They'll just stand in it and absorb that water through their feet into their body, and they die a drowning-like death. So it's really important that we have shallow waterers, that we have sufficient space, because typically birds standing in water are the ones that are crowded in there because there's not enough room for them. So make sure you've got sufficient space. And if there's a couple of aggressive birds that are picking on the weaker ones, those weaker ones need to have somewhere to go and get away from the aggressive ones. So redundancy on the heat and water is really important.
Redundancy goes back in with preventative measures that we discussed earlier. We really got to kind of stay ahead of these things, make sure that we've got appropriate pens, make sure that we're managing disease and pests by kind of mitigating that with whatever we're putting down in our cages, and really keeping an eye on that. I think that's going to be the big takeaway from today, is just preventative, keep an eye, be redundant, and go that route.
Those are excellent points, Tyler.
Anything else that we want to discuss about brooding today?
I would just like to say that you can, when you plan on the number of eggs that you want to incubate, you know, if let's say you're going to homestead mindfully, that means we're only going to produce as many chickens as we think we're going to eat. So I like to back into this and ask your family, how many times a week do you eat chicken? And we're not talking about your lunchtime stops at Chick-fil-A. We're talking about the number of times you actually prepare a chicken meal. And truthfully, that's usually only about once a month that somebody would fix chicken. You know, the average working household eats very little chicken meals. So if you're going to prepare a whole chicken once a month, your family may only need 10 to 15 birds annually. But then we want to plan on approximately a third of your brood dying and a third of your eggs not hatching. So we need to incorporate that. So let's say if we needed 12 birds, we would have to add a third. So that'd be now 15 birds, and another third, that'd be 18 birds. We're going to incubate 18 eggs, hoping that we'll end up with 12 fully raised chickens. So you got to plan on that mortality rate when you incubate and when you brood.
Well, that, that speaks to only butchering one time a year. Correct. So if you're butchering, you know, quarterly, you need a quarter of that.
Do the math accordingly. That's correct.
That's definitely some good considerations. Bo, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I'm right there. Sounds good.
All right. Before we do our conclusion and wrap up our episode today, I'll let Joe introduce this. We had some more listener questions, which we are super excited about. Joe, do you want to tell us a little bit about this listener that reached out to you and what some of their questions were?
Yeah, gladly. And I'm really excited. We had a listener call and discuss the fact that she had a couple of steers standing in mud. She's new to Missouri. She comes from California, where things are much drier, but Missouri has got a couple of things that I'm sure she didn't have to deal with. Number one is a lot of rain, and number two is a grass that's very popular here, very common, called fescue. But her concern was that her cows were spending a great deal of time standing in the muddy spot in her pasture. And I think without seeing the situation, but just jerk knee reaction for me was that her cattle are suffering from an issue we call commonly as fescue foot. And that basically is the bovine's body response to endophyte toxins, which is a fungus that grows on the fescue grass that's commonly found in Missouri. When the cows eat it, they eat the fungus. The fungus is a toxin. It causes the capillaries in their feet to shrink, so they're not getting good blood exchange, and their feet become very hot. They don't feel comfortable, and they don't get the blood flow that they should have. So they have to go either stand in a pond or stand in the mud. And you can bet in Missouri and in other areas where fescue is an issue, and I'm going to say all of your South and Midwest is going to have fescue, we need to prevent that process by feeding what we call a high mag mineral. And about any feed store you go to and tell them you need a high mag mineral or you need to combat fescue related toxicity, any of them will have a specific brand available that's going to combat fescue foot, or even some that are called heat products, which is a mineral based typical bovine minerals that has an elevated level of magnesium that will help fight that fescue foot.
I know one of the things that you discussed, she reached out and said that she did have a mineral block in her field. And I know one thing I've seen a lot about is free choice minerals. There's a guy, and I can't think of who it is, but he put out a video and he's got a mineral feeder, and he has, instead of doing a mineral mix, he's got magnesium in one little bin on this mineral feeder. And then he's got salt in one little bin on this feeder and various other minerals. Why is that important?
So two things, and you're touching on two different mineral programs, and I'm glad you did because they're very important. The first one, the mineral block, a cow or a horse, their tongue is not well designed for only licking off of a block. Sometimes their mineral requirements are far greater than what they can lick. So they need to consume larger volumes, and that's only achievable by using a granulated mineral. So if we go buy a bag of mineral and we put it in a mineral feeder, sometimes you see them, they look like a big, maybe a giant flat bushel basket with a rubber lid. The cows can go in there and lick the mineral in larger volumes than what they could ever get off of a block. So loose mineral over mineral blocks any day of the week. Now, the second thing you talk about is what we call the mineral buffet. And a mineral buffet has got a lot of traction here lately. I know a lot of great homestead guys out there that are big proponents of it. But the fact of the matter is the mineral buffet has not been factually vetted. Again, that means that no land-grant college has proven it to be better. But there's a lot of lay people out there, a lot of very successful cattlemen and goats people that can attest to the success of the mineral buffet. And the mineral buffet is just that. It's each mineral as an individual and not a blend. So if the animal is suffering from magnesium deficiency or fescue foot in this case, it can go eat straight magnesium and it'll leave the other things like sodium or cobalt or copper alone. That's depending on the animals to know their own body. And for me, the jury's still out. While I offer a variety of minerals, I have not seen enough evidence on my farm to say that the mineral buffet is outperforming the branded bagged mineral that comes from a company that specializes in the exact right blend of minerals for different age or different reproductive cycles or different species. I guess when we talk about the difference between loose mineral and mineral buffet, it's just to do your own homework and make the choice. I've had both available on my farm for a number of years, and the jury's still out for me. So do your homework. Talk to some folks that are very experienced. I do know that Greg Judy here from Clark, Missouri, is a big fan of the mineral buffet. He might be a good one to reach out to on that. I think his website is Green Pastures. So I have a great deal of respect for those guys and certainly don't want to take anything away from it. But at my farm, I've not seen the evidence yet.
I know this is a great spot for our other listeners to reach out if they're doing the mineral buffet or if they've done research on it. I come out of healthcare. So for me, the gold standard is, a college that's done a study and we've got, a double-blinded study, and we've got, some hard evidence to support these things. But that doesn't mean that I totally discount anecdotal evidence.
No, not at all.
I think anecdotal evidence does go a long way to point us in the right directions, and it's what leads us to the studies and the research that we would call the gold standard for that.
Sure.
So if you're listening and you've got anecdotal evidence on any of this, if you're seeing a lot of success, or conversely, if you did it and you saw zero success with it, reach out, let us know. This might be something that we can, certainly will probably be something that we revisit in more depth later on, but we definitely do appreciate this listener reaching out and bringing her questions, and we're excited to see maybe if you guys have any thoughts on it or suggestions. We definitely want to listen to those as well. Bo, do you have anything to add to this conversation? Have you had experience with the mineral or
I'm doing the same thing, and I think the mineral buffet looks really cool, sounds really cool. I hope it works, but I'm not there yet on our homestead. Even if I wanted to try it, I'm not quite there.
I know for me, which Bo's seen me, well, Bo and Joe both have seen me at a Mexican restaurant, I will turn that salt shaker upside down, unscrew the cap, and, beat any grain of salt that's left in the bottom of it. I feel like personally in my own diet, I kind of know when I say I kind of know, I don't wake up and go, damn, I need some salt today. But when I eat and as I have different cravings, I feel like that's a good indicator for me of what I'm lacking in my diet. So I, I don't see why it wouldn't apply to cattle or livestock as well.
It's important to realize that the bovine species was successful for eons before man began to keep them in a stall. So certainly they were paying attention to those cravings like you do, and did it successfully. So the mineral buffet really and truly has its story to be told. I can't say that I've seen it in my estimation, in my observation. I can't see where I've seen the animals focus in on one particular mineral.
Well, it could be a thing that, you know, not all things have to be true and beneficial. So it could be true. You know, they could identify what minerals they need. Is it worth the hassle to build this buffet and do all the work for a negligible benefit? Are you improving the livelihood of your livestock by doing this? Maybe the jury's out on that.
I will say this, though. No blocks, guys. No blocks.
Loose mineral. All right. Well, I think that wraps up everything that we've had to discuss today. Bo, do you kind of want to summarize any key points that we made today, any big takeaways for our listener as we talk about care and maintenance?
So I'm going to go back to the nugget I picked up from Joe. I think you've got to be careful where your feet are at, because that's where your animals, you know, beaks, mouths, noses are all going to be. I am not somebody that has special shoes for those occasions, but I'm going to have, you know, a real nice selection of Crocs in my house for different things now. I just wear the same Crocs for everything, so I'm going to change that up a little bit. But that's my key point, you know, from today. Different shoes, wear Crocs if you're cool, and be careful what you're stepping in.
If anybody at Crocs is listening, I wear a size 9.5, Joe.
12.
11. So we'll keep an eye out for those in the mail.
The official footwear.
Farm Foundation footwear.
Joe, do you have any key takeaways that you want to plug today before we wrap things up?
Just that, guys, sanitation is key. You know, if I had to pinpoint one thing that makes my food better for my family, it's that I know how those animals have lived. We let them live clean, we let them live naturally, and we let them live with dignity. And I just think that we need to focus. No one wants to eat where they shit. And I know that's coarse, but I just think it's mighty unfair for us to steer animals and force them into filth. So the cleaner the better, guys.
I think for me, really the big takeaway was prevention. And I know we hit a lot of those points when we start this lifestyle and you start homesteading. You're going to check a lot of boxes that really boost you in that venture. But interact with your animals, make sure you're touching your eggs, make sure you're touching your animals and you're with them every day. And you can mitigate these problems before they become problems. All right, guys, if you haven't done it already, we want to follow our Facebook page. Get on there. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. I think we're working on getting TikTok. We're trying to get out some more videos on a regular basis. So hopefully we'll be on TikTok by the time you hear from us next week. Reach out with your pictures. Give us your feedback. Tell us whether or not you liked the series. So this series was kind of a new thing for us. Well, this whole thing's kind of a new thing, but I enjoyed the series. If there's other topics that you want us to do a series on and really break down in that closer detail, let us know, and we'll definitely look at those as well. I think next week we're going to be back and we're going to talk about bartering. That's something that everybody's done a little bit of this week, so we're excited about that. And that's a wrap for today's episode of Farm Foundations. We hope that you have found our discussion on poultry care and management both informative as well as helpful in your own homestead endeavors.
If you guys have any questions or topics you'd like for us to cover in future episodes, don't hesitate to reach out to us on social media or through our website.
And that's right. And please be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. We have some exciting topics lined up for future episodes that you won't want to miss.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Until next time, happy homesteading.